I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to Radio Times. Well, things are heating up when it comes to Pennsylvania politics. Republican Senator Pat Toomey announced that he is not running for re-election in 2022, and a lot of political hopefuls are running or going to be running for his seat. And with a 50-50 split in the U.S. Senate, it will be a race to watch, and we will get you up to speed a bit later on in the show. Here in Philadelphia, the DA's race is getting some national attention. Incumbent Larry Krasner, who campaigned on reforming the office and has support among progressives, is being challenged by career homicide prosecutor Carlos Vega, whom Krasner fired when he took office in 2018 and is supported by the Philadelphia chapter of the Fraternal Order of Police. Charles Peruto, who was a Democrat, has switched parties and is running against Krasner as a Republican. This contest is taking place against a backdrop of rising gun violence in Philadelphia, and the primary is in May. Joining us is Chris Brennan. He writes about politics for the Philadelphia Inquirer, is lead writer for Clout, which describes itself as an often irreverent column on people, power, and politics. Chris Brennan, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's very nice to be back. Thank you.
Nice to have you back. And also back with us is Akilah Lacey. She's politics reporter for The Intercept. She joins us by Skype. And Akilah Lacey, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Nice to be back as well. Thanks, Marty.
Absolutely. And to our listeners, you can always join us. We're going to start with Philadelphia and then move out to the rest of the state during this hour. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us at 1-888-477-9499. Akilah, let me actually begin with you, because normally a DA's race is either a local issue or maybe a statewide issue, but here in Philadelphia, the DA's race is getting national attention, including from The Intercept, your news organization. What is the national interest in this race?
So there are a couple of key pieces here that I want to pull out. I mean, Larry Krasner has, you know, gotten national attention for his approach to prosecution in Philadelphia, as, you know, a wave of similar sort of reform-minded district attorneys have taken office both before Krasner and after his election. But at the same time, the reason that some of these races are you know, so important on the national scale, particularly this cycle, is that obviously, given the sort of the national uprisings against police brutality last summer and calls to reform the police, both from inside police departments and also reforming the criminal justice system from the perspective of prosecutors, have gained traction. We're seeing police forces double down sort of on their fight against those movements. And so we're seeing sort of that play out with Larry Krasner in Philadelphia, as you mentioned, with the FOP supporting his opponent, Carlos Vega, and the FOP sort of supporting anyone who would run against Krasner in either in his previous election. And that is being mirrored in cities across the country. Kim Gardner in St. Louis is a prosecutor who has faced intense backlash both from police forces and local politicians for her approach to prosecution. Same with Chesa Boudin in San Francisco. So this is a pattern that we're seeing all across the country. And so this race is a bit of a bellwether for that that struggle that's ongoing.
Chris, let me get you in on the conversation. And Larry Krasner ran as a progressive, talking about reforming the judicial system, ending mass or reducing mass incarceration. It's a, you know, a long but I would say familiar list of things that he ran on. Now, 4 years later, did he live up to those expectations and his own criteria for what it would be to be a successful DA?
I think a good way to look at this is the first piece of campaign literature that Krasner sent out about 2 weeks ago. And it was a glossy mailer with a long pull quote from a man named Chester Holman, who was released from prison thanks to Krasner's Conviction Integrity Unit, which has gone back and looked at the cases of 19 people who have been freed from prison because they were wrongly convicted. That's an incredible change in culture for the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office, which, when it was headed by Lynn Abraham, the New York Times called her the deadliest DA in the country because she was so so frequently seeking the death penalty. So I would think that Krasner has changed the office in the ways that he spoke about 4 years ago. I do think it's important, though, to remember that in the Democratic primary 4 years ago, there wasn't a lot of daylight between the seven candidates seeking the office. I mean, everybody sort of sang from the same hymnal when it came to things like reforming cash bail or diversionary programs for people dealing with addiction issues. So I would say that Krasner has made major changes in the office, but he wasn't the only person who ran on that notion.
And I notice his slogan is, for this go-round, is promises made, promises kept. So, Chris, if people are keeping a scorecard, they can sort of check off what he did and what he didn't do.
That's absolutely correct. And I think if this race were not unfolding in the middle of a terrible spike in gun crime and homicides, Krasner would be in a much more comfortable position.
Well, let me go back to you, Akilah. We're here in Philadelphia, and Philadelphia, frankly, like some other cities, has been experiencing this, you know, worrisome, troublesome, violent increase in gun violence. And I wonder, you know, part of a district attorney's job, it's not the entire job, is to make people feel like they live in a safer city. How do you think this might play out?
So this is definitely something that Vega and the FOP are sort of hitting Krasner over, that, you know, Vega came out launching his campaign saying, you know, Krasner doesn't care about the victim, that he doesn't care about the violence that has plagued the city, you know, for a very long time, and that is the spiking again now. It's interesting that sort of the narrative or the conversation always gets brought back to what the district attorney can or can't do, right, particularly when sort of the center of this fight is coming around the local police department and questions around, well, like, what can the police do and what have they not done to sort of tamp down on violent crime in the city. So I think it's sort of a game of, you know, they're both pointing fingers at one another, but I think that takes away from looking at actually the root issues of the root causes of crime, and which we know are often linked to intense poverty. Right now, we're obviously still in the middle of a pandemic where people have lost their jobs and don't have a way to earn a living and have been pretty desolate, you know, for the last year or so. And so those things are just as important as talking about, you know, what the district attorney can or can't do to keep people safe. I think the other side of that question is one of the reasons that so many people are supportive of Larry Krasner is because many people in Philadelphia have been victims of police brutality, victims of injustices caused by the criminal justice system. And so I think they have questions about, you know, how his office is helping to reduce those harms that have been caused sort of from the system out. And then also, again, looking at, you know, whether or not his policies incentivize crime, which I think is not necessarily the right question. And looking at, you know, how all of these systems come together to put people in these positions or allow, you know, allow sort of lack of accountability, both for people who commit violent crimes and then also lack of accountability for people who are wronged by the system.
Chris, let me pick up on that and shift it slightly. And I'm looking at a headline. It was in, I think it was a Sunday Inquirer, gun arrests soar, but convictions fall. And it picks up on this issue that Akilah was talking about the responsibilities of the DA, the responsibilities of the police department. In this article, it's a long one, the DA, Larry Krasner, what accounts for the drop in convictions, I'm just quoting here, says factors such as witnesses missing court or police submitting weaker evidence. The police commissioner, Daniel Outlaw, talks about the justice system becoming a revolving door. Sort of looking at this particular issue, and of course, you know, crime affects everybody, whether you live in a violent neighborhood or not. Do you think this will be a key issue?
I do think it'll be a key issue, and I've seen Krasner at campaign forums in the last couple of weeks, and he offers a series of explanations for what's going on. I mean, he rightly notes that the spike in gun crimes and homicides in Philadelphia matches something that's happening in big cities across the country, even as violent crime itself is decreasing slightly. Krasner says that some of the problems are witnesses not showing up for cases. He sometimes blames the police for not bringing strong cases. He sometimes blames judges for releasing people. And I mean, I think what we have here is, if you're inclined to favor Krasner, those explanations will ring true to you. But if you're inclined not to favor Krasner, that sounds like passing the buck. And the question is, can Carlos Vega capitalize on that?
Well, let's pick up on Carlos Vega, and he is challenging Larry Krasner. Chris, let me go back to you. Krasner fired him, you know, for just about four, I guess, 3 years ago when he took office in 2018. This, he kind of cleaned house in those first couple of weeks that he was in office. How much do you think this is personal?
I definitely think there's a personal element to this. And they had met before. I mean, Carlos Vega is a career prosecutor who spent 35 years at the U.S. or the district attorney's office. And he had prosecuted cases where Krasner was a defense attorney. And Vega was one of 31 prosecutors that Krasner fired in one of his first actions in January of 2018.
And he does have he meaning Carlos Vega, and we lost Aquila. Well, we will get her back. We heard that little sound that meant I think her Skype fell apart, but we will get her back. Carlos Vega, he is supported by the local chapter of the FOP. How significant is that, Chris?
I think it's a significant. They are an effective messaging outfit for politics in the city of Philadelphia. They've given him the maximum allowable donation of $12,600, both in 2020 and 2021, and resources are necessary in a race like this. And Vega has proven himself to be competitive when it comes to raising campaign donations. You know, if you look in places like Roxborough and Northeast Philadelphia, Andorra, I mean, these are places where the FOP message gets heard.
We're almost having a break here, Chris, but a quick follow-up. I saw a quote from Vega saying, "My campaign is not pro-police." Can you explain that?
So Vega makes the point that he has, in the past, as a prosecutor, prosecuted police officers for criminal behavior. Essentially what Vega is trying to do is be a hybrid of what Krasner offered. Vega is not against reform. He just thinks that Krasner's policies have created a less safe city.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Chris Brennan. He writes about politics for the Philadelphia Inquirer, a lead writer for Clout. Also with us is Aquila Lacey. She's politics reporter for The Intercept. And we're beginning today's show looking at the DA's race here in Philadelphia. The primary is in May. And an interesting challenge to the incumbent Larry Krasner. And of course, we want to hear from you. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. We're going to take a break. We'll talk more about the DA's race and then talk about the U.S. Senate race in Pennsylvania. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. We'll be talking in just a couple of minutes about the Senate race in Pennsylvania. Election isn't until November 2022, but a lot of people are getting in on the action. We're talking now about the DA's race in Philadelphia that is under a microscope, getting a lot of national attention. Incumbent Larry Krasner, who ran on a progressive reform platform, is being challenged by an attorney. He fired Carlos Vega, in the May Democratic primary, and talking with the Philadelphia Inquirer's Chris Brennan and Aquila Lacey, who's a reporter for The Intercept. Aquila, I'm sorry we lost you. We have you back. And I was talking with Chris Brennan.
Sorry.
Oh, that's okay. This is just the world we live in these days, trying to connect with people all over the world through the internet. Nonetheless, you had an interesting piece, actually in today's paper, ProCop PAC tried to fundraise by blaming George Floyd for his own death. It's a complicated story, but I wonder if you can, and I hate to do this to someone, but just what is the essential message from this story?
Sure. And I just want to give a shout out to Chris, who wrote about this first for The Inquirer and informed a lot of my reporting on this. But essentially, the Protect Our Police PAC, which started last June, several retired Philadelphia police officers started this PAC basically to target Larry Krasner specifically, and also to elect, quote unquote, pro-police candidates across the country. They're a state PAC in Pennsylvania, but they're spending, I think they've backed candidates in at least 15 states since they started. But last week, as Chris reported, the PAC sent a fundraising email that blamed George Floyd for his own death and said that that Derek Chauvin was on trial for a murder he didn't commit, along with some other concerning things in the email. And so we basically wrote about this and the fact that this is not the first time that the PAC has distributed racist materials or problematic sort of messaging. They had put up billboards and sent out mailers in a district attorney's race in Chatham County, Georgia, last year, where they had photoshopped an image of the current district attorney holding up a sideways peace sign that local activists and media thought was designed to look like a gang symbol. There was also speculation that they had darkened her image. And the candidate that the PAC was backing, you know, said the content was distasteful, and they ended up taking the billboards down. The PAC at that point had said, you know, that you know, criticisms that was racist, or and there was also actually George Soros was on the mailer, and there was some writing about how he was trying to buy the criminal justice system, and so there was anti-Semitic sort of messaging in that too. And so the PAC said, you know, all this is a distraction and is not, you know, not founded in anything. They changed their tune this time around. It seems that after the Inquirer reached out to them about this email, that they put out a statement blaming the email on a national marketing firm, saying that they had since ended their relationship with the firm. But when I reached out to the PAC, they answered some questions and then did not stopped answering questions when I was asking about if they could name the firm, if they could if they had returned any of the contributions that they had received as a result of the email, and why the firm ostensibly had not shown them the email before they sent it out, which is pretty common practice when you're working for a client. So that's the gist of the story. Yeah.
Chris, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, I had the same experience. I tried several times to get Protect Our Police PAC to name the firm that they blamed for the email and to explain how the email process worked, and they just didn't respond to any of those questions. But they did. I do agree that it's a shift in their response. We previously reported about what had happened in Georgia, and they had firmly rejected any notion of racist or anti-Semitic language in their approach. And this time, they just flat out renounced their own messaging.
Interesting. Let me ask you about Charles Peruto. I'll put this to you, Chris, Republican candidate. He was a Democrat, and he's challenging Krasner. Why so?
So Chuck Peruto is a longtime defense attorney in the city of Philadelphia, very colorful guy, always fun to write about.
Storied family, is he not, in Philadelphia?
Indeed.
That Peruto
indeed.
Name?
A. Charles Peruto Jr. Is his full name. So Chuck was a lifelong Democrat. He actually voted for Larry Krasner 4 years ago. Chuck tells a story about, it's an interesting one, about he claims Larry Krasner is bad for business, that defense attorneys are... in his telling, are suffering because they have fewer clients, because they're not needed as much, because alleged criminals are getting such great deals from the district attorney's office. That's his messaging. Chuck sounds like he's channeling the ghost of Frank Rizzo when he speaks these days. It's all lock 'em up, Law and Order stuff.
Do you think that'll, I mean, I guess that'll play for some people in Philadelphia, but Republicans have such a, you know, a hard hill to climb in this city because there's so many Democrats.
That's right. Registered Democratic voters outnumber Republicans 7-1. And remember, 4 years ago when this was an open seat, an accomplished prosecutor by the name of Beth Grossman did the same thing. She crossed over from Democrat to Republican and ran for the office, ran a credible campaign, and she got 25% of the vote in November's general election.
Now, there are – just another quick question to you, Chris. There are some registered Republicans who are switching – to Democrat, I think more than 3,000. What's the significance of that?
So that's an effort that the Fraternal Order of Police is trying to assist. And this mirrors something that Ed Rendell did way back in 2002 in southeastern Pennsylvania when he was running against Bob Casey for the gubernatorial nomination. He got moderate Republicans to register as Democrats. His campaign promised to switch them back to Republicans afterwards, but this was so that they could vote for Rendell versus Casey in that year's primary. And so what is now happening is people are trying to get Republicans to register as Democrats so that they can support Carlos Vega in the Democratic primary. Yeah. Vega says his campaign has nothing to do with that, but we did an analysis of where the switching is happening. And it is essentially the FOP's base in Northeast Philadelphia is really driving this.
We're going to move on in just a couple of moments. Akilah, anything you want to add that we haven't talked about, especially about this DA's race?
Yeah, actually, that on Chris's last point, POP PAC, Protect Our Police PAC, is very vehemently saying that they are not backing Carlos Vega and that their primary target is taking down Krasner, which, you know, you can draw your own conclusions from that. But I just wanted to point out on the switching registrations, the PAC president, Nick Grace, was on a YouTube video several months ago, basically explaining exactly how Republicans could switch their registration to vote in the Democratic primary to vote out Krasner. And so obviously in that case, they would be voting for Vega. And it's also, you know, some people around the race are expecting that the PAC will end up doing an IE on Vega's behalf at some point. But again, they're both distancing themselves from one another at this point.
What's an IE?
It's an independent expenditure.
Okay. That's okay. Yeah, we got to make sure people understand those letters. Here's some other letters. And Chris, this final question about Philadelphia. Help us understand the Horn and Hardart, the H&H coffee can, how that works in this city when it comes to ballot position.
So this is a remarkable piece of Philadelphia political ephemera.
It sure is.
Horn and Hardart was an old automat, cafeteria style chain.
I remember it well. Yep.
When I was a kid, if my dad brought home Horn and Hardart's rice pudding, it was a big treat. They had their own brand of coffee, and there is an old Horn and Hardart coffee can that's kept in a safe and secure location at the Philadelphia Board of Elections. And to choose ballot position for local races, the Board of Election drops bingo balls, numbered bingo balls, into the Horn and Hardart can, they shake it, and then candidates are get to draw their ballot position. The first candidate who submitted their nomination petitions gets the draw, and the second, and so on. And so in a race like it's not really determinative in a race with two candidates like Vega and Krasner, but if there's a crowded city council race, drawing the first ballot position can mean everything.
Wow. Some traditions just never die. That is Chris Brennan, and he writes about politics for the Philadelphia Inquirer, a lead writer for Clout. Akilah Lacey joining us as well, and she's politics reporter for The Intercept. And we're going to shift gears now. We were talking just about the DA's race here in Philadelphia, but if you have any questions about that, you can certainly send them to us because our guests are going to stay with us. And again, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. And we're just curious whether you have made up your mind. Of course, the DA race and the primary is in May. Well, from the DA's race to the race in Pennsylvania to fill Republican Senator Pat Toomey's seat in 2022. He announced a few months ago that he would not run for re-election, which has jump-started what promises to be stiff competition to fill his seat. Pennsylvania is still considered a battleground state, and with a Senate that's evenly divided between Republicans and Democrats, along with independents who vote with the Democrats, the winner of the Pennsylvania race could tilt the balance of power or not. Some of the declared Democratic candidates, Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman, State Representative Malcolm Kenyatta, Montgomery County Commissioner Valerie Arcush. On the Republican side so far, it's developer Jeff Bartos, commentator Kathy Barnett, and Trump ally Sean Parnell, who told The Inquirer he is 99% on the way to making his run official, and we are continuing with Chris Brennan, Philadelphia Inquirer reporter, and Akilah Lacey, reporter for The Intercept. Akilah, you're kind of our outsider looking at what's happening here in the state. How significant is it to have an open seat in such an important state at such an important time, frankly?
It's absolutely crucial at this point. I mean, when Pat Toomey announced that he was not going to be running for reelection, you know, it was expected to sort of be a very long, drawn out contest, which is proving to be the case. I mean, you know, Democrats are obviously looking at this as a possible pickup for them. Republicans are looking at it in the same way. Obviously, there's a very tight balance of power in the Senate right now, 50-50 with each party. And so it's incredibly important, particularly when you think about the role that Pennsylvania played, you know, in the election last year and also in 2016. Obviously, we were waiting on Pennsylvania, you know, as one of the last places for votes to come in. And people were, you know, very uncertain about how, you know, some of the three sort of pivot counties in the state were going to go, whether they were going to continue and go again for Trump, if they were going to go for Biden. And so this is sort of, again, Philadelphia and Pennsylvania tend to be sort of a microcosm of what's going on across the country. And this race will definitely be another area where we're seeing, you know, sort of the battle, both I'm looking at it more from the Democratic side. So the battle between sort of moderates and progressives, wondering exactly how they can win over, you know, either moderate voters or some of the thousands of Republicans who have now switched their registrations to Democrats since November in Pennsylvania.
And we're almost, Chris, just a quick answer, if you could, to this question about why Toomey didn't want to run again. Do we know?
You know, the thing about Pat Toomey is you never really know what he's thinking unless he tells you. I do think that he had sort of run his course. He had been expected to not run again, but to run for the Republican nomination for governor. And he apparently decided that that was not for him either. Hmm. So I think he's going back to the private sector. Well, where he was very successful before his time in politics.
Well, you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Chris, let me go back to you. And are you surprised? I mean, I listed some of the candidates, and there are others that are, you know, they have their fingers, I guess, in the wind to sort of see which way the wind might blow. Are you surprised that there are as many candidates as there are, you know, more than a year out from the election?
We did expect a large crowd to seek. An open seat always draws a lot of interest. But I pulled together a roster while thinking about what I would say today. And I've got 16 to 20 names here. That's a
really?
Lot of people. Yes. And some of them are currently hold elected office, so they don't have to jump in quite as early. They can sort of survey the field. But it's on both the Democratic and Republican side, we have a huge number of potential candidates. And interestingly, there could be some rematches here. I mean, Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman is in office because he defeated, he and Governor Wolf defeated the Republican ticket. And Jeff Bartos was the Lieutenant Governor candidate in 2018. That would make for a very interesting matchup because these are two guys that actually like each other, that became friends on the campaign trail. So that would make for a very different kind of Senate race, especially considering that control of the Senate hangs in the balance and that midterm elections tend to favor the party that does not hold the White House.
And did we lose our guest? We did. We did. We lost our guest. We will get her back. Well, let me follow up with you then, Chris. This is, you know, this is live radio and in the year 2021 when we've got people on Skype and all over the place. Let me ask you about John Fetterman. I think he raised almost $4 million. He says these are all very small donations, but nonetheless, that is a lot of money. He is a very high profile candidate as Lieutenant Governor of Pennsylvania. What should people know about his candidacy?
So to put John Fetterman in the context, this is a guy who was profiled by Rolling Stone and The Atlantic when he was mayor of Braddock, which is a small former steel mill town in Allegheny County, not far from Pittsburgh. He's been building a brand nationally for some time now, and he is now positioning himself as something of a political brand and financial juggernaut that cannot be overcome. I don't know if that's going to be accurate, but that's definitely how he's trying to position himself.
And, I mean, he's been on the show multiple times. I mean, he's been on, I guess, everybody's show. That's part of, you know, how he gets his name out there. And, Chris, it's more than just the fact that he's, what, 6'6", and he's got tattoos, and he wears shorts in the middle of the winter, and, you know, is very active on Twitter, as is his wife. It's more than that, though, right?
Yeah, I mean, they're very social media savvy. I once joked with him that when you first meet them, it's like the World Wrestling Federation walked in the door, but then the Harvard School of Government starts coming out of his mouth. He's very wonky. He went on a very well-publicized listening tour around Pennsylvania before declaring that marijuana should be legalized for recreational use. He has both a grasp of the policy and sort of the performative politics that drives it.
Akilah, you're back. You're back by phone, and we're almost up in a break. Just a quick thought about Fetterman, and then we'll pick up on Fetterman and you after this very short break. But give us your 20-second pitch here.
Yeah, so I agree with what Chris said mostly. I mean, Fetterman has obviously staked himself out as sort of the lead candidate at this point. He raised, $1 million in 2 weeks in January and has more than quadrupled that at this point. But I think Chris's point on the performative politics of all of this is that Fetterman is very careful about which policies he does adopt, despite being, sort of very, positioning himself as a progressive. Like on this issue of fracking, he's been pretty unclear on where he stands on that, and has, again, recently said that he does not support a ban on fracking, which, if you're talking about sort of the goodie bag of progressive policies that people tend to back, that's a big one.
That is, and he's had that on Radio Times. We're going to take a very short break. That's Akilah Lacey. She's politics reporter for The Intercept. Also with us, Chris Brennan. He writes about politics for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Much more after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We're talking about the Pennsylvania Senate race in Pennsylvania. We realize it's more than a year away, not till 2022. But nonetheless, a number of candidates or hopefuls have tossed their names into the ring. We've been talking about Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman. State Representative Malcolm Kenyatta is another candidate. Montgomery County Commissioner Valerie Arcuche, she announced this week. That's on the Democratic side for Republicans. We're talking about developer Jeff Bartos, Trump ally Sean Parnell, who's about 99% of the way to making it official. Political commentator Kathy Barnett also wants to run on the Republican side. Talking about all of this with Inquirer reporter Chris Brennan and Akilah Lacey, reporter for The Intercept. And again, you can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Akilah, let me pick up on something you said earlier about John Fetterman, and he has said that he supports fracking, at least in the sort of interim. And I wonder how you think that will play among progressives who see him as their progressive candidate.
I think it will be, a sticking issue. Like, I don't think this is going to go away. I mean, looking at the state broadly, is supporting fracking going to hurt Fetterman in the long run? I don't think that would be the case. But as we're looking at sort of cities like Philadelphia and Pittsburgh moving further and further left in recent years, seeing, really progressive candidates like Sarah Innamorata and Summer Lee and Nikhil Sabal and Krajewski, elected to the state house and Senate in recent years, is signaling that these cities are probably ahead of the candidates on most of the candidates on some of these issues. So I think, in those cities, it will probably be a bigger negative for Fetterman. But again, it's very far out, and he has sort of been careful not to stick too fine of a point on this, and I think he's giving himself a little bit of wiggle room on the issue, which is smart in the long run, because he knows that it could be an issue in areas with more higher numbers of voters in these cities.
Chris, you wrote about this incident. I don't want to spend a lot of time on it. It happened 8 years ago. Fetterman was then the mayor of Braddock, Pennsylvania. He confronted a man with a shotgun, a guy named, Christopher Miaris?
That's correct.
And there was some, he chased him. He thought he was, there was some gun incident, put the gun in his face. He has denied that it was exactly as Miaris had described. I'm not doing a very good job here. I should probably toss this back to you, Chris. But interestingly, Miaris, who is in prison now on a totally unrelated issue, has supported Fetterman for U.S. Senate.
So this is some opposition research on John Fetterman that's been out there since he first ran for the U.S. Senate in 2016. And he was mayor of Braddock. His story is that he heard gunfire near his house. He was with his young son. He put his son in the house, jumped in his truck. He says there was a shotgun in his truck, and he chased down a man that he saw running from what he thought was a gun crime. Turned out to be this man, Christopher Miaris, who said he was simply jogging. It was January of 2013. And Fetterman says he held the shotgun in his hand, but not pointed at Miaris until the police arrived. Miaris says that Fetterman pointed the gun directly at him and held him until the police arrived. So it came back up when Fetterman announced earlier this year that he would run for the Senate again. Right. And he's been very sort of cautious about dealing with this because, there are a lot of problems with the optics of this. A white guy holding up black man with a shotgun, assuming, that he is a perpetrator of a crime. Miaris, I wrote to him in prison, and he wrote back, and he said he holds to his story. He says that, in his words, that Fetterman lied about everything in 2013, and still he says he hopes that Fetterman gets to be a senator.
And Miaris is serving an 18 to 36-month sentence after being convicted in 2019 of kidnapping, terroristic threats, unlawful restraint, and other crimes against a woman. Just to sort of put that into context, and people can make of it as they will. I do want to move on and talk about Malcolm Kenyatta, state representative. He announced not so long ago. And Akilah Lacey, let me go back to you. What do you make of his candidacy?
Malcolm Kenyatta is a pretty serious candidate. He's already sort of made that clear. He rolled out an endorsement from the current mayor of Braddock earlier this month, which is a bit of a shot at Fetterman. But Kenyatta is another candidate who, he's gotten the endorsement of the Working Families Party. And so and I'll just point out that John Fetterman is working with the Progressive Polling Firm Data for Progress. And so that's just one example of where sort of progressive groups might be splitting between these two candidates. They are at least sort of working on, positioning themselves as who is the more progressive candidate. Kenyatta is someone who has, moved further to the left in recent years. He was a very early supporter of Joe Biden. I think he came out and endorsed Biden just a few days after he entered the race last cycle, which is something, that people were talking a lot about when he first announced his campaign how progressive are you if you're going to come out, immediately and endorse Joe Biden. But Kenyatta has sort of tried to get out in front of that, has talked about how, his mother was a huge fan of Hillary Clinton because of her work on the SNAP program, and has sort of embraced his positioning, his relationship with sort of the moderates of the party, and sort of putting putting that aside and saying that he can still continue to work for progressive policies and won't necessarily sort of fall into the more moderate spheres that we see, Biden and Clinton orbiting. Kenyatta is definitely going to be giving Fetterman a run for his money. I mean,
Does he have money?
We don't know how much he's fundraised yet, but obviously it's nowhere near, $4 million at this point, which is what Fetterman has. So it will be an uphill battle, but I think Kenyatta's base in Philadelphia will be formidable for Fetterman, for sure.
Let me put Montgomery County Commissioner Valerie Arcush. She just announced this week Chris Brennan. She's a physician. She led the county's efforts to contain the coronavirus pandemic. She's a woman. What do you make of her candidacy?
I think she's another very strong, very credible candidate. I do think that the geography of Pennsylvania in this scenario, if the field were set today, might favor Fetterman simply because Valerie Arcush from Montgomery County and Malcolm Kenyatta from Philadelphia would be two people competing for southeastern Pennsylvania votes, mm-hmm. while Fetterman would be alone out there in the West. And Fetterman has a fairly strong base here in the Philadelphia region anyway. So, I you know, it's not just the candidates here, but it's how many candidates and where they hail from. You always have to consider the map in Pennsylvania.
Here's a question from Robert. He says, in the Republican Senate primary, former Congressman Ryan Costello from Chester County is likely to run as a centrist Republican, but who will be competing with support for the Trump base in the Republican primary? And if you don't mind, Chris, I'm going to toss that back to you. He hasn't declared yet, but it looks like he's certainly looking at the horizon.
Absolutely. And this has been a fascinating sort of shift in political driving in Pennsylvania. I mean, the old model used to be that you would run to the left or the right. If you were a Democrat, you would run to the left in the primary to win and then try to get back to the center in your positioning for the general election. If you're a Republican, you would run to the right. Nobody did this better than the late Senator Arlen Specter,
right.
who was just moved on the political scale wherever he needed to be, whenever he needed to be there. In this, Ryan Costello is very much running, or very much would run as a centrist if he enters the race. Fetterman, I would say, has actually been drifting away from the sort of the left. You know, if you speak to him now about the word progressive, he sort of shrugs it off as, you know, not being a label that, you know, necessarily means anything to him. And then we have a fair number of Republicans that are either running or thinking about running who would run all the way to the right, all the way to the Trumpist right.
And that would be what, Sean Parnell?
Sean Parnell would be one of those. I think Kathy Barnett would probably fit into that. There's a attorney from Montgomery County who is the brother of County Commissioner Joe Gale. Sean Gale has declared he would be very much to the hard right. Jeff Bartos, who is sort of your average, he's a declared candidate. He's sort of your standard Chamber of Commerce Republican, but his rhetoric has shifted hard right since he declared.
Oh, fascinating. You know, it's interesting, Akilah. I mean, this is broadly speaking, when we, especially at like a Senate race, you look at who the senators are now. We've got a Republican and a Democrat. I would say, you know, I was a very moderate Democrat at that, Bob Casey. So it's interesting to think of these, at least we might describe them as progressives, even if they are running from that tag. It's interesting to think of that in Pennsylvania, having progressive candidates.
Right. And I think that's sort of, you know, that's sort of what is the crux of this whole race, right? Like, is it, you know, when you're talking about national politics and the way that it's moving, it makes sense to have candidates like Fetterman and Kenyatta sort of, you know, bubbling up to the top, you know, in, again, what is a very early field. But the question is, does that matter in the long run in a state like Pennsylvania? And will the national attention that Kenyatta and Fetterman have already gotten over, you know, supersede how voters in Pennsylvania really feel? As we know, you know, a lot of the fact that you said at the top of the hour that like these races are getting a lot of national attention, and so it'll be interesting to see how that dynamic plays out when you're talking to actual voters in Pennsylvania. But one thing I do want to add is that sort of the ethos that progressive consultants or groups in Pennsylvania and around Philadelphia and Pittsburgh have been sort of targeting is that these policies that Kenyatta and Fetterman are running on, you know, things that will help people who are struggling economically, providing people with health care, getting rid of arcane drug laws, that those don't have to be partisan issues. We've seen that be successful in some areas of the state and not so successful in others. And so I think that will be the messaging around that and how that is conveyed will you know, determine, you know, what happens here for sure.
Chris, a comment from Ben says he thinks the Fetterman shotgun story will sink his candidacy, considering the national conversation around race. Do you agree?
I do think that Fetterman is concerned about it based on his approach, as it's been reported since he entered the race earlier this year. Fetterman is usually a get on the phone, talk it out kind of guy. He, when it comes to this sort of thing, he speaks through his campaign and through prepared statements. I don't know that it sinks his campaign, but I do think it's a situation that he's negotiating very carefully.
And negotiating what, with himself or with his team?
With his team. Mm-hmm. I mean, the thing to keep in mind about this 2013 incident is everybody is sticking to their story.
Right.
In the end, there are two very different versions of events. I think an interesting line, a bit of political analysis sent to me from state prison. Christopher Mieres, in his letter to me, said that he thought that it would actually be politically damaging for Fetterman to change his story about what happened in 2013 now.
There you go. I don't even know how to respond to something like that. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Let me squeeze a couple of more names in, and I'm looking. These are all members of Congress: Representative Connor Lamb, Madeline Dean, Chrissy Houlihan, Brendan Boyle. Akhil, if I can go back to you. Now, things are tight in the House, so, you know, so that there's that. There's also the upcoming, you know, census and the possibility of redistricting. What are you thinking when you look at those candidates, potential candidates, I should say?
Yeah, so, you know, Connor Lamb, Chrissy Houlihan, Madeline Dean, you know, more actually on Lamb and Houlihan, we would be looking at them as jumping into the race as more moderate candidates, and, you know, potentially hoping to capitalize off of some of the split in progressive votes between Fetterman and Kenyatta. But, you know, congressional candidates have the added advantage that they can take their time and jump into the race at a later date because they can fundraise without declaring. Obviously, they will also be looking at what happens with redistricting, because if they have a favorable redistricting map, then they might not want to, you know, make this bid. But I think they will be holding out as long as possible, until they actually have to make a decision. I know some are having meetings, you know, as early as next week to talk more about the decision. But yeah, people are definitely watching that closely. I mean, people are pretty certain that Connor Lamb will jump in. Obviously, that could change. I think Chrissy Houlihan and Madeline Dean are more of question marks at this point, though.
What do you think, Chris? We're almost up at the end of the show, but what are your thoughts?
So Brendan Boyle said on social media a couple days ago that he's decided to pass on the race, so he will not be in it.
Okay.
I do think there's a strong chance that Connor Lamb enters the race. That gives us another potential rematch, because Lamb defeated Sean Parnell narrowly for his congressional district last year. I do hear, you know, I've heard talk that Chrissy Houlihan may have some supporters in the Senate leadership now. I don't know if Madeline Dean enters the race. I'm not sure about that yet.
Even with her high profile as part of the impeachment team?
Exactly, yeah. I mean, I do think that they have the benefit of being able to move later in the game.
I hear you. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Chris Brennan, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. He writes about politics for the Philadelphia Inquirer, is lead writer for Clout. Akhil Lacey, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you, Marty. It was a pleasure.
A pleasure. And she is a politics reporter for The Intercept. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. To find out more about the program, you can always download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. It's very easy to do. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you for joining us.